This is Reaganism, a podcast dedicated to exploring where the Reagan movement lives today. I'm Roger Zach. I'm your host, director of the Ronald Reagan Institute in Washington, D.C.
On this episode of Reaganism, Roger sits down with Doug Cameron, a reporter who covers the global aerospace and defense industry, as well as the airline sector in the Wall Street Journal's Chicago Bureau. They discuss collaborative combat aircraft, the National Defense Industrial Strategy, emerging technologies, and the future of warfare.
Doug Cameron, welcome to the show.
Roger, it's good to join you.
Well, you are a veteran Wall Street Journal reporter out of the Chicago Bureau, where you focus on aerospace and defense industry. You have been looking at our national defense and the industry which supports it for quite some time. Let's just get the overall assessment, Doug. What is the state of our national defense industry? Two things seem to be happening at once. On the one hand, there seems to be a recognition for the first time, perhaps in a generation or more, that the defense industrial base is not where it needs to be. And at the same time, there is almost a moment of significant technological revolution. Perhaps those words are too strong, you can correct me, where we see new technologies coming in and possibly disrupting, perhaps displacing the way industry needs to provide platforms and capabilities to our military. Give us the state of our national defense industrial base.
Well, Roger, I think it's a classic case of everything's changed and everything stayed the same. I've been doing this beat for the best part of 10 years, and literally I can go back to stories I wrote in 2014. About companies warning about what would happen if supply chains, if production lines rather, went cold, the weakness of some supply chains, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, budget warnings on top of that. Lots of chatter then about innovation and what was going to happen. Fast forward 10 years and you have a pretty similar story. So I think that kind of sums up where we're at with the defense industrial base. These warnings have been there for a long time. Some have been listened to, many haven't, and you know, we've dug ourselves into a big old hole, which is proving much more difficult to get out of than basically everybody thought.
So interesting, giving that a decade-long perspective, and it kind of resonates what you're talking about. From you know, we had some futuristic kind of defense platforms. I'm thinking of, you know, future combat systems. Yeah. But there was a decided move away from having deep industrial capacity. The famous Last Supper, where during the 90s, after the Cold War, the guidance from the Department of Defense was to the defense industrial base, thou shall consolidate. Certainly after 9/11, there was a need for more, but it was really on a lower end sort of capability in the form of ground vehicles and MRAPs and things that you would need in a Iraq or Afghanistan scenario. The thing to me, Doug, I love your perspective on this, and we'll go to some of your reporting here in a second, is that the technological developments, and I use the language of revolution, is very much felt in an acute way in 2024. Perhaps it wasn't as profound in 2014 or 2004. And here I'm really speaking about autonomy and platforms infused with digital, you know, software and AI. That to me seems like the market change, where we didn't quite have that a decade or so ago, in the same way.
And what's obviously underpinned that has been advances on the commercial side of the house. The advances and then the making things cheaper, basically. So the commercial side has moved on in leaps and bounds. And of course, the defense side has cottoned on to this, that they're looking for mass, they're looking for scale, they're looking for affordability. So of course, they're going to look at what the commercial side has developed. And now, you know, some of these things are basically ready for prime time in a military capacity in a way which, as you say, they weren't 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago.
Well, let's talk about one example you've written on, which is the collaborative combat aircraft. And of course, you need to speak in acronyms if you're talking about anything DOD, military. See, my example immediately went to an acronym, the Department of Defense and Military, CCA. This is the Air Force's new hope to really integrate autonomous systems along with fighter aircraft, and you know, there'd be manned and unmanned working in collaboration. Doug, tell us about CCA and kind of whether in your mind this has the significance in terms of a technological jump, and also answers a couple of things you just hit on a moment ago, where we can kind of have something at scale and perhaps for pennies on the dollar.
Well, to avoid acronyms, we settled on calling it a fighter drone, which just, I think, put a vision in people's minds.
Anybody picking up on that, fighter drone?
It's super catchy. So yes, they want this at scale. There's 1,000 F-35s out there. How do we get 5,000, 10,000 of something with complementary capabilities out there? And that's the task for industry now. As you know, Roger, this isn't a new program. It's gone through various iterations. So, you know, we're not going from 0 to 60 in 3 seconds. We're going from 0 to 60 in 7 or 8 years. But now is the time to move, and now is the time for the contracts actually to be put out. One concern for industry, and this is where their pushback is that the price point of this planned aircraft has kind of moved up a little bit, which is going to eat into obviously the affordability and how much you can scale it up. The other problem is just when you're trying to make so many relatively of something that is still, after all, a fighter jet with all the complexities that go with that, there's not really a precedent for production at that scale of such a complex vehicle, given that you have to bring in, you've still got to get engines. Okay, you don't need life support systems for a pilot, but a lot of pieces need to come together. So yeah, it's a classic test of can we deliver and field at scale. And you know, it's not that the whole shop is riding on this, but it's one that industry is looking very closely to see where all the talk, all the drive, all the strategies, all the reports from the Pentagon will actually turn into dollars and contracts.
I sense a little bit of skepticism there. I'm trying to read you. You're right to point out that it takes a lot of time and there are a lot of questions unanswered. And we've certainly seen promises in the past and things haven't really come through, certainly at the speed and scale that was promised. I am curious, though, do you think this is the sort of thing you mentioned price, you mentioned quantity, you know, swarming of drones being a kind of an element of a strategy. Here, we're really not, when it comes to collaborative combat aircraft, we're not talking about maybe tens of thousands anymore. I think we're talking about thousands, at least initially. Yeah. And instead of it being, you know, $100 million a platform like we have, you know, with the F-35, for example, you know, we're not talking about hundreds of dollars. You're talking about tens of millions of dollars, right? I mean, give us a sense of what this is going to cost and what we're talking about in terms of numbers.
Well, the mantra from the Air Force is still that it'd be a quarter to a third of an F-35, which kind of all in flyaway is, you know, it's $100 million and change. So you are talking about something that's 25 to 30 million. Industry would say that this needs to come down to below 15, more like 10, to get the economies of scale where they can sustain that level of production. So that's going to be a challenge. Now, in fairness, they're going to be iterations of this. The plan is we're going to be iterations. You know, we'll call it Fighter Jet 1 followed by Fighter Jet 2. You know, the first having a very clear role in terms of air-to-air combat, supporting crew jets, and other later iterations would have an ISR role, maybe a air-to-ground role. So they're, you know, they are trying to walk before they run. But still, you know, this just hasn't been done, and it has been talked about for years. You know, we have been on this path for several years now.
Now, for our listeners and viewers who are more sophisticated defense followers and NASCAR followers, we talk about a lot here on Reaganism. Still, explain why this is so perhaps fundamentally different. We have for some time in our Air Force used remotely piloted aircraft. We've had Predators, and then the next iteration were Reapers. They were critical to our counterterrorism operations, hovering and in what you would call a permissive environment. That is, they weren't really in any way going to be taken out by the adversary in the skies. That, of course, is no longer the case, whether you're dealing with a Russia or China. But we have kind of done this with predators and reapers. Why is this so different, Doug?
The difference with AI-driven, autonomously piloted aircraft is not that the AI technology really makes things happen any faster. The decision-making isn't any faster than a pilot. And, you know, physics dictates that a plane can only go up, go down, go left, go right at a certain velocity. What it does is the learning. The AI technology has the experience equivalent to, you know, millions of flight hours of, you know, thousands and thousands of pilots. And basically it can kind of take account of every eventuality in a way that a human couldn't. Obviously experience improves a human pilot's ability to react. But the whole point of an AI is that they can react to multiple different and changing scenarios. So that is where, you know, they're looking to get a competitive edge and advantage, not just in terms of numbers and in scale and in price, but also in terms of their ability to carry out the mission. They can carry out the mission in a different way.
Now, you've written about this and noted that there are roughly, you know, five or six vendors that the Pentagon is looking at. Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, those are what you'd view as, you know, the traditional defense industrial base. General Atomics also included. That is the company that came up with the Predator and Reaper. And then Anduril Industries, which is a very recent newcomer to defense base, founded no more than, you know, probably about 7 years ago or so. Give me your take on these players and how you think the Pentagon is racking and stacking them. If it goes to a Lockheed or Boeing, is that an eye roll saying, well, we're just going to get what we've got in the past? In other words, are the traditional defense industry able to do what you're describing in terms of an AI platform? And if it goes to a company like Anduril, you know, what's the confidence that they'll be able to scale and deliver production in a capacity like, you know, a traditional defense company has done for decades?
Well, these companies can all build aircraft. The four that you mentioned, the four traditionals, obviously have a long track record. Anduril, as others in that space have done in the VC-backed space, have come into it through acquisition. They basically, you know, bought the company that makes the Fury, which is at least going to play a part in their offering. So they're making a bet that they can buy into what they hope will be a program of record. I think it's likely and expected that the down select from five companies will be to two, maybe three. And that speaks to the level of production and just the preference to, you know, try and spread the risk and not rely on one production line, rely on multiple production lines. They'd definitely be making a statement, obviously, by picking Anduril as one of the two or three, just to... You mentioned the Last Supper before. I remember the competition for the F-16. I don't remember it because it was 60-odd years ago. But anyway, there were five vendors. Now, you know, the Air Force doesn't have five vendors to pick for any large airborne platform these days, but they would love to have three. That would be an improvement and give them some a cushion going forward. So if they pick Anduril alongside one of the established, and who knows, we may see different partnerships involving Anduril. They might not go it alone. You might see different partnerships between the established players as well. So there's a lot of ducking and diving and, as I say, alliance building as well, underpinning these big planned programs, at least.
You know, one of the things that made collaborative combat aircraft so interesting to me is, in some ways, it's the best indication that we've entered a new world, if this happens. Here's what I mean by that. I'd love to get your reaction. If we actually are able, that is, the Department of Defense is able to get this platform, procure it at scale, what that means is, one, we're going to be fighting differently. In other words, that the way the United States engages in a conflict in the future, just like I guess we had with precision guided munitions and stealth, you know, a couple of generations ago, now our military would have entered the AI age. And until, this is the second point, until there is a program of record, right, then it's really just kind of happy talk where we get to go to conferences, some of which the Reagan Institute's put forward, right? And have people talk about the future of warfare, or how AI and the private sector, commercial companies are shaping, you know, our military. But, you know, until you have this program of record, that's just words. So Doug, give me your reaction. If we get this thing done, does it mean that, okay, we've actually changed our military into the future of warfare?
It is literally one platform. And as we know, platforms can kind of ups and downs during their life. Now, it's let's see when it's fielded at a scale and integrated into both US command and indeed, importantly, into allied command structures. There are also kind of parallel allied efforts in the autonomous vehicles which are going on. So there's a long way between building it and fielding it at scale, I think, before you can make any kind of qualified judgment that, yes, we're fighting in a different way.
So you're right. There's other programs, emerging programs, none quite like CCA, although I'm prepared for you to correct me on that, across other services that are going to be using autonomy, whether it's the Navy and undersea capabilities, the Army in terms of their ground vehicles, or elsewhere in the Air Force, future tanker that's unmanned the like. Yes. But the other place we're seeing this, and here I'm going to move to reporting by some of your colleagues at the Wall Street Journal, is the battlefield in Europe right now. It also extends to the Red Sea and Gaza too, but we can just go to Ukraine, where the line of contact, that area in eastern Ukraine where Russians and Ukrainians are battling it out, it's a combination, Doug, of 20th century howitzers and 155 rounds of artillery and first-person view FPV drones, you know, with explosives attached to it that are taking out armored personnel carriers. And in that environment, as I'm trying to capture what I'm hearing about in Ukraine, I had a chance to be there last week, not the front lines in Kyiv. You have electronic warfare being used where, as your colleagues at the Journal report, U.S.-made drones have largely failed in Ukraine, in part due to Russian electronic warfare capabilities. My point in raising Ukraine, love to get your reaction, is we're seeing it integrated into the battlefield right now at scale. Obviously, cruder sorts of drones, nothing that the Department of Defense plans to buy.
It's interesting with Ukraine that military leaders and indeed many in industry will talk about how many lessons are being learned on the battlefield now in Ukraine. And then in the next breath, we'll see how that doesn't apply to any potential conflict in Indo-Pacific because of the tyranny of distance and just a more maritime domain than a land domain. So yes, undoubtedly lessons are being learned, but I honestly think they're being they're being tucked away in a box for later use without doubt. But the bigger eye still remains the Indo-Pac theater and the technology that will be required there. Now, EW, jamming, all that sort of thing, contested logistics, contested environments, that's definitely a lesson that's been learned in real time in Ukraine. But I don't think artillery and, $2,000 drones, which aren't going to fly 500 miles between islands, are not really seen as particularly applicable. So the contested environment, I think, is the biggest lesson from Ukraine. But so much of the resources, as you know, Roger, are being directed at Indo-Pac.
Yeah, the Indo-Pacific, you're right. And a fight on continental Europe is probably less applicable, or clearly less applicable, to how you would imagine a fight in the Indo-Pacific between the United States and the People's Republic of China, and or United States supporting a friend like Taiwan in the event of a PRC activity against the island. I wonder if there's more than contested logistics here. I mean, the Ukrainians, for example, and I saw this firsthand, have developed crewed long-distance drones that are carrying significant warheads on them that travel 1,000 kilometers, that are taking out Russian infrastructure. Companies are doing this, Doug. I mean, you find this fascinating, just given your coverage of U.S. defense industry. Companies that a year ago were not producing anything are now producing these at like $40,000 a pop. I got to think there's something to be gleaned from that, even as we look to the Indo-Pacific theater.
I think I'm going to come at that from a slightly odd angle. But yeah, the vulnerability of infrastructure, including your production infrastructure, was actually something. I was at this military logistics and maintenance conference here in Chicago yesterday. And very, very quickly, the general who was talking started making the assumption to the industry participants there, where he said, okay, just assume that the adversary takes out the grid. How are you going to make anything then? He went straight, you know, it was like Monopoly, you go straight to go kind of thing. So I do think the contested environment, be it logistics or indeed be it production, from that kind of asymmetric warfare, they may be homemade drones now. They could certainly be mass produced in a more regular fashion.
I'll give you one more, and it's very interesting what you hear there, because the homeland is vulnerable, more vulnerable to military attack, kinetic sort of attack than I think Americans really understand. It's not just with a hypersonic capability that could penetrate our airspace without us having any defense, but certainly that might be the most prominent example. I mean, the Ukrainians, for example, their own very modest defense industries developed a Neptune cruise missile that's taken out Russian vessels in the Russian Black Sea fleet, which has effectively moved the Russian Black Sea fleet out of Ukrainian ports and have allowed for a corridor for Ukraine to now export their goods, their agricultural goods and other goods. Like, remarkable that you know, a long-range cruise missile that the Ukrainians developed could have what is clearly kind of a strategic impact. Let me throw one other at you, Doug, because you had said that the United States is thinking Indo-Pacific. It is. That's where defense strategy drives. And therefore, the laboratory of Ukraine perhaps has less to teach or provide as we deal with the Indo-Pacific problem set. My words, not yours, but that's the way I took your point. The Deputy Secretary of Defense was here at the Reagan Institute not too long ago, Dr. Kathleen Hicks. And she, of course, interestingly, did not mention the replicator program, but is one of her signature initiatives whereby she is seeking to procure for the Department of Defense low-end, cheap drones at scale. And in her argument for it, when I asked her about it, was, well, if Ukraine can do this and get them for pennies on the dollar, we ought to do the same. And clearly, they have some use on the battlefield. Give us your take on Replicator, its place, and its chances of succeeding in this 18 to 24 month window that the Deputy Secretary of Defense has given.
Well, the clock is obviously ticking on this. From a purely professional point of view, I wish it was much more public than it is currently portrayed. And I think, frankly, many in industry would prefer that too. In fairness to Dr. Hicks, I think she's made it very clear that you shouldn't think of it as a kind of stovepipe program. It's a process. It is a different way of thinking, taking lessons from Ukraine and what can be done at scale, what can be done quickly if the resources are put in place. So, yeah, I think it would be an important moment. The problem with keeping it slightly under wraps and ultimately picking a few winners, which is what's going to happen, at least in the first iteration, is that if something does go wrong, if it falls on its face a bit, because these may be cheap, but they're still, you know, they're still relatively complex bits of machinery, depending on their task, particularly if they're, say, counter UAS as opposed to just attack drones, so to speak. Then focusing on just a few companies, a few winners, could frankly lead some not to take part in the next round and the next round. So it's a difficult path for them to pursue. And I understand why they're doing it the way they're doing. It's a process, not just a program, but they certainly want to affect change. And
let me ask you one follow-up on that. And then I want to talk about what some of the adversaries and enemies are doing when it comes to drones. But you've articulated some of the risks involved there, right? That they make down select a few companies. They have run into some issues. We can imagine all along the kind of acquisition and procurement process, or even if they operationalize them, you know, there's risks involved there. What does success look like, Doug, on the Replicator program? If you had to imagine it.
I think they have a bit of wiggle room with the timing, but you know, if they get 1,000 in 28 months, I'll just give them an extra 4 months. Then I think that, and from 3, 4, 5 different companies who also are able to demonstrate that, okay, we're up to 10 a month now, and here's our path to 20. We've got the supply chain sorted out. So I think the fielding is one part, but I think equally importantly is what's coming next. Okay, you've got your 1,000. Where's the next 1,000? What's the timeline for that? I think being able to demonstrate that they have their arms around the supply chains, because a lot of them are going to be going to the same suppliers. So I'm sure you're going to see a little bit of to and fro between the companies there. But I think that's I think that's what success looks like, that you've built a base. It's okay fielding, as I say, hundreds, but you have to show that there's now a capacity to turn that into thousands, and then
I would add to that cost. Are they really able to get these things, you know, or, you know, if the Ukrainians are putting out drones at the hundreds of dollars, so you could 10x it, just given that everything costs more in the United States, yep. You know, but could you really get something for under 10 grand a pop? That would be unbelievable. Or even let's call it 100 grand a pop. That would still be pretty consequential, given the price and cost to do business with the Department of Defense.
Do you remember when the hypersonic missiles were going to cost $2 million the pop?
What was that? $2 million. What was that for? Like the discussion? You know, what it cost to bid on it.
Or the box that it comes in.
Yeah, there we go. We're talking to Doug Cameron of the Wall Street Journal, veteran reporter on the aerospace and defense industry. Done a lot of reporting on DOD, the military's use of autonomous systems, in particular, really groundbreaking work on collaborative combat aircraft. All right, let's move on, Doug, to the development on the policy level. In the Department of Defense, we had, as I mentioned, the Deputy Secretary here. She talked about the National Defense Industrial Strategy. The Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition and Sustainment, Bill LaPlante, led this effort and talking about it as if this first of its kind industrial strategy. My own view is about time. It's absolutely necessary given the need to deal with the PRC and the People's Liberation Army and all the challenges in Indo-Pacific. And of course, wars in Europe and the Middle East. I mean, it's quite clear that we need an industrial strategy. Give me your take on it, its features and questions you have about it and questions you think it answered.
I think that the policies that follow the strategy, it's what industry is looking for. If you go back to both during the pandemic and at the start of the Ukraine conflict, both the Pentagon and industry swore blind that they had their arms around supply chains, that they knew where the weaknesses were. Fast forward 3 years, and that's still not the case. Supply chains being beholden to potentially hostile nations that have critical minerals for whatever still remains a huge problem. The bureaucracy that companies have to jump through to deal with the Department of Defense for all the reports, for all the talk, remains a big challenge. I know I'm in the Midwest, which is, you know, we make things here. And there's a lot of companies who are not venture capital backed who do work for the DOD or try to do it. These are tier 5, tier 6 companies. So, you know, they're making the widgets, they're making the printed circuit boards. They have a lot of difficulty just trying to get everything signed off to get the security clearances. DOD is trying to help. It's certainly improving things, but these companies often have difficulties getting, you know, never mind venture capital, just getting a bank loan, even though they've been doing this business for 20, 30 years of this track record. So I think one of the issues I have with the strategy is the reliance a little bit on on a new breed of companies and suppliers coming through. But in fact, that's great that they are. But there's a thick vein of companies that have been supplying for years and have been innovating as well, making basic stuff that's required. You know, you need a screw for a Minuteman missile. You need a screw for a Sentinel missile. And I think they're being a little bit ignored, would be the way I would put it, by the strategy. So the policies that underpin that and to help not just the new breed of manufacturers and developers, be that hardware or software, but also to bring along those who are already there.
It's a great point. I have one follow-up question, but I want to react to what you just said about the strategy. You know, you're talking about these venture-backed companies and perhaps the industrial strategy reads as solicitous to them and forgetting about the tier 5 and tier 6 suppliers that we need for the current platforms. And the platforms, if you look at the current defense program, we're going to continue to use. And I think of it almost like as Tesla versus cars that are, you know, not EV cars, the regular, you know, engines. And you look at the number of parts required for an EV engine versus, or the whole car versus what you need for a gas guzzling Detroit, you know, vehicle that put before you today, I still drive. The Department of Defense does not have the luxury of just making a pure fleet of Teslas and giving up on all the old gas guzzling vehicles, because so much of what our military will fight with is not being replaced by new technologies. I mean, you mentioned the Sentinel, right? That's one third of the triad, right? These are the nuclear weapons that are responsible for the deterrence that is increasingly being strained and tested, but is entirely necessary. And you can go on and on across our air, land, sea forces, and even extends to space. So the industrial strategy absolutely needs to reach down to those tier 5 and 6 suppliers of more conventional capabilities. But if you look at what the Department of Defense is focusing on as well, it's not just those venture-backed entities, it's those companies that are making many of the things that are critical for the fight in Ukraine. For example, we were talking about the 155 rounds. How much is this strategy driven by the reality that there is insufficient capacity for basic warfighting needs like ammo, like artillery, that we hadn't been paying attention to before because we had sort of this just-in-time manufacturing mindset?
Well, you know, DOD has said so many times, as of many, many lawmakers, that ammunition and indeed maintenance repair became a bill payer, particularly in a post-sequestration world after 2013 when I started doing this. So, you know, I think people were aware of what they were doing, but they still did it anyway. I remember Doug Bush, I think it was at the recent Reagan event, where he said, thank goodness someone decided to stockpile this sort of rare gunpowder, even though they'd stopped production in the 1980s, because at least he was able to go back to that stockpile and then presumably reformulate it and try and restart.
You're talking about Doug Bush, who's the Assistant Secretary of the Army for acquisition, right? And he found something that was absolutely critical that we had stockpiled and people had forgotten about it, which was critical for ammo, right? And weapons.
That's absolutely right. So production had stopped of that particular ingredient, that particular chemical. Meanwhile, on the ammunition side, because of the peaks and troughs in production, there just hadn't been any updating of the machinery. You know, you go into these plants and they are almost medieval, Game of Thrones like swords makers, lots of clanking and fire. So it's taken a while to get production to where it is, because they had to bring in new machinery. And by and large, the US had stopped making the machinery that was used to make the shells, for example. You know, it's being brought in from Turkey, in the case of one plant in Texas. And the Turkish company had to build the unit, make it, test it in Turkey, dismantle it, ship it to Texas, then rebuild it. So that's where your log jams are, getting the machinery. And of course, we haven't talked about it yet, but the talent, as we used to call it, we'll just call it workforce and people now, finding and training, even in what is still a tight jobs market is a tough task.
No doubt. That is one of the long poles in the tent. My own view on the industrial capacity challenge and many of what the elements you just articulated is that for the recapitalizing our military, so we're not relying on tooling, that Doug, you just got to Game of Thrones sort of manufacturing facilities, is that we're going to need some sort of CHIPS Act-like investment to recapitalize our industrial base, because the current defense program, even if you add a few percentages every year, is not going to have the capital to do that. And you know, there are some interesting things happening. One of the things that was interesting about Secretary Hicks's visit here at the Reagan Institute was when she was asked to talk about innovation in national security and defense, she talked about industrial base. And when I called her on it, she was emphasizing that we need innovation in terms of how we manufacture and produce goods. How much of that have you seen in terms of use of, let's say, 3D printers and additive manufacturing and other ways which perhaps give you pathways to recapitalizing that don't require kind of traditional investment in tooling?
Well, I try not to be too cynical here. I really like factory tours, and I go in quite a lot of factory tours. It's not a huge stretch to say I've seen more 3D printers gathering dust in corners than actually being used. Now, undoubtedly, they're being used and being used very effectively. But a lot of people kind of struggle to use the technology. They get a 3D printer, and then they find that certification process for whatever part that they're making with it is just complicated so many times because they're doing it in a non-traditional way. So, you know, there can be hidden costs. Now, undoubtedly, there are more and more things are being qualified more quickly. 3D printing is proving to be very handy. Factories of the future, streamlining production. There's certainly things being made in a different way, but you can make it things in the old-fashioned way with lathes as well, just more efficiently. And what I find interesting actually was there was a while where the defense industry actively tried to mimic what was going in the automotive industry. Much higher volumes, obviously, in autos. That's where just-in-time came from. Then, you know, just-in-time kind of broke down with the pandemic, and the auto industry sort of pivoted away a little bit from that. And you're seeing a bit more of a disconnect between the defense industry saying, yeah, we can actually try to mimic that level of mass production. We have to tailor things more for our making things in the hundreds or thousands and not the millions. So I think the management consultants have been hired, they've been in, they've not always been hugely successful. So the defense industry, a lot of them are going kind of back to basics, but using some of the newer tools, be it 3D printing or whatever, to try and be efficiency isn't everything. I tell you what's the most common thing I hear from folks in industry now? It used to be the 90% solution, Roger, and it's become the 70% solution. Good enough. Obviously, you know, tolerances, if it's a spacecraft or a fighter jet or a nuclear weapon, you're going to need your exquisite. You're going to need your 100%. But for a lot of things, the 70% good enough has become more of the mantra. And companies are prepared to sacrifice a bit of productivity, a bit of efficiency for getting things done and out the door.
Yeah, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. And trying to get to scale seem to be some of the lessons of the current security environment and the current fiscal environment that we're just going to have to work with what we have. And no good trying to be exquisite and perfect and end up having one or two or none of the capability you need. Doug, let's go to our lightning round. We're wrapping up our conversation with Doug Cameron of the Wall Street Journal, veteran reporter on defense and aerospace. Here's where we ask all our guests to give us their favorite Reagan speech, quote, or book. We'll take all three, two, or just one. Doug, what do you have to share with us?
I can do your quote. So I'm in Chicago, and this is something you said at a news conference here long before I arrived in the city, but I'll try and get it right. But, you know, here are the nine scariest words in the English language. I'm from the government, and I'm here to help. He was actually talking about the farm industry, then. But if you read the transcript of the news conference, he kind of segued into defense and SDI and whatever. So I just think that that's, it sums up so many of the issues and the tensions between the customer, i.e. the DoD and industry right now. They would love you to come and help. So
that's a great one. Doug Cameron, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks very much, Roger.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Reaganism. New episodes premiere weekly every Monday on YouTube and all podcast streaming platforms. If you like this episode, be sure to let us know and share with a friend.